Hi, everybody. My name is Barbara Anderson. I'm very grateful, Alan. And my anniversary in this program is March 19th, 1984. So I've been around a little while. I'm glad to be with y'all. Just out of curiosity, how many people in here have been to an Al-Anon meeting? Okay, that's pretty good. Those of you that haven't, I promise I don't bite. And one of the things that when I first came in, it was all about family recovery. You know, there were AAs and Al-Anons everywhere I went, and everybody hung out together, and there was usually both meetings in the same place. It seems like more and more it is not like that anymore, and I'm sad about that, but I appreciate that y'all included me in this event today. I'm going to be talking about forgiveness, and a lot of it's going to be my own story, because there's examples in it of forgiveness. But I want to start by sharing with you my 12 steps before Al-Anon. Number one, I discovered I was powerful over others and that your lives were certainly unmanageable. Two, came to believe that I was the power that could restore you to sanity. Three, made a decision for you to turn your will and your life over to the care of me. Four, made a searching and fear-filled inventory of everyone that I knew and found them lacking. Five, admitted to God, myself, and anyone that would listen the exact nature of your wrongs. Six, became entirely ready to assist you in removing your defects of character. Seven, humbly, assisted you in removing your defects, except when to do so would cause me harm. 8, made a list of all persons that had harmed me and vowed to get even with them all. 9, waited for everyone to make direct amends to me. 10, continued to take your inventory and when you were wrong, promptly pointed it out. 11, sought through martyrdom, mothering, managing, and manipulating to improve your conscious contact with me, asking only that you read my mind and carry out my wishes. And 12, having had a complete physical, emotional, and spiritual breakdown as a result of this type of living, I tried to drag all those I love down with me and get sympathy and pity from all who would listen. And I'm just telling y'all right now, I know that I'm going to end up tripping over this mic thing the way it's taped here before the day's out, because it's right where I'm going to disconnect it because it's right where I'm standing. Anyway, so hopefully that doesn't happen. Although I have fallen on my face in the middle of a talk before. My two biggest fears were that I would fall on my face. I tripped off the stage once. And the other is that I'll have to go to the bathroom during the middle of a talk. And that might happen today. So I'll just give y'all a break if it happens. So anyway, I'm glad y'all are all here. And I thank Megan for inviting Dick and I to be a part of this. As I start, I'd like encourage you to think about your own life and think about anybody in your life that you have yet to forgive. It could be an old resentment. It could be a new one. It could be an employer. It could be an issue that happened this week. It could be that something that happened on the way to this conference today. But think about any resentment, anyone that you have not completely forgiven in your life, or it might be, as Dick shared earlier, it might be God that you haven't forgiven. I'd also like for you to think about, is there anybody that you would like to forgive you? I think that's often true. We have somebody that we know is holding resentments against us, and sometimes you even feel more powerless over that. But if there are those people, I'd like for you to keep them in mind as I share today, too. Because there may be something, or there may not be something, but there may be something you can do about that as well. I'm going to try to move this a little bit. Okay. I might be different, a little bit different than y'all, but I think I suffer from alcoholism, too. When I first came into the rooms of Al-Anon, I was spiritually bankrupt. I was physically ill. I had ulcers. I had intestinal problems. I had asthma. I had an active eating disorder. I was suicidal half the time. I was depressed. But nobody ever knew because I had a smile on my face all the time, and I was there to help anybody who needed to be helped at the sake of myself. I really had no real life other than helping other people. And that's often the truth for Al-Anons. And because we don't have the same physical effects of alcohol, our body is eating itself alive from the anger and the resentment and the fear and the self-pity. And sometimes we don't even recognize it because we have stopped allowing ourselves to feel. I know that was true for me. I was kind of like an empty shell, and the outside of me was a mirror. And I would reflect to you what you wanted to see. If you were happy, I was happy. If you were sad, I was sad. If you were celebrating, I'd celebrate with you. If you were grieving, I'd grieve that too. If you hated somebody, I'd hate them with you. If you really liked somebody, I'd probably adopt that too. And it just was the way I was. You know, people pleaser was not a term that I knew when I came into Al-Anon, but that was certainly me. You know, my family, the family that I came from, I was, Dick used to say that the Allen family motto was either, I don't care, whatever you would like to do, or was hide out, because we would do one of those two things. But our answer to most questions was, I don't care, whatever you want to do. When Dick and I first started dating, and I'll tell you a little bit about how that happened, but when we first started dating, he asked me if I had any alcoholism in my family, and I told him no. That's about how much denial I had in my life. I am, of my grandparents, three of them were of the four were alcoholic, and there was also a step-grandfather. On my father's side, my dad's dad tried to commit suicide when he was 7 years old, and he died in the North Carolina State Mental Institution 5 years later. And my father could barely remember what his dad looked like, so he snuck into the funeral home to see his dad one last time. And what he saw was a body with both arms and both legs broken, and the body was black and blue. And my dad had never told anybody that. He just kind of tucked it away in his memory bank, and he told me about it a while later. And I did some research, and I found that that was kind of the treatment for alcoholism in those days. They would try to, or at least this experimentation they were doing in North Carolina, they would try to shock it out of them by breaking a limb or by beating them. Now, that's only two generations ago. That's what happened to my grandfather as a result of his alcoholism, and he died before AA started. But it's, you know, it's not that long ago. My dad came from a long line of alcoholics. I found out a few years ago that my father's family had and I didn't find this out from my father. I found it out visiting a museum in Mount Airy, North Carolina. But I found out that my dad's relatives perpetrated the worst courthouse shooting of all times. It was about moonshine, and it was kind of a cross between the Hatfields and the McCoys, and kind of a Romeo and Juliet element to it. There was a member of one family that had fallen in love with a member of another family, and things didn't go so well, and a big lawsuit happened, and there was a big courthouse shooting. And when I went to this museum, there were posted 14 faces that all looked like my dad. And they were the same last name, Allen, and I suddenly realized while my dad didn't talk about his family much. But he was also from Rockingham, North Carolina. And if you know, Rockingham, North Carolina, this is how Al-Anons sometimes create, you know, our fantasy life. In Rockingham, NASCAR was founded, okay? And NASCAR came from moonshine running, okay? So my relatives were moonshine runners, and they were in Rockingham. So I now believe that my family invented NASCAR, okay? It's much better than the other. Actually, you know, it's funny how as time's gone on in the program, the things that I would have never, ever told anybody are like the exciting stuff you want to tell people. My mom's mother and father were both alcoholic. My grandfather came from a long line of money, and his dad gave him some money and said, make something of it, and you get some more, and make nothing of it, and you get nothing. And my grandfather went through all the money, and his father wrote him out of the will, and actually he was buried originally in a pauper's grave. Later they moved him. But his wife was my grandmother, my mother's mother, and she was the alcoholic I knew most growing up. So I had these two adult children of alcoholics who had no idea how to be parents because they had not been parented well. And on my mother's side, almost everybody else in the family is alcoholic too. And when it came to the weekend, they liked to spend their time together. So I would spend the time with my grandmother most every weekend. This was my mom's mom. And the first thing we did every Saturday morning was go to the liquor store. I didn't find it unusual. We went to three of them. Green's, Happy Herman's, and Tower, if you've ever been in that part of town. And, you know, it was just a normal Saturday morning event. And it was probably illegal then, but the owners would take me behind the counter and they would give me some candy or a toy, and they would talk to me while my grandmother did her shopping because she was a very good patron. And I used to wonder why she would go to three. She told me she was bargain shopping. But I don't think she wanted the liquor store owners to know how much she bought every week. So we'd finish the liquor store errand, and then we'd be off on some kind of adventure. My grandmother was very colorful, I used to think. But really, whatever we did had to surround somewhere she could get some alcohol during the day. We usually went out to some fine ladies' establishment, like Mary Mac's Tea Room or something like that, and she would have her three martinis, and I'd have my three Shirley Temples. And then we would either go to a Broadway show because they had an open bar, or we'd go to the symphony because they had an open bar, or we'd go to a beer garden and festival at Piedmont Park, or sometimes we'd go and try on ball gowns at Regenstein's or one of the other places downtown. And I found out from some of my AA women's friends that they usually gave the women a glass of wine or two to drink while they were trying on those expensive dresses. Sometimes she'd get her hair fixed, and also found out that she would probably get a glass of wine or two while they fixed her hair. But, you know, she was, whatever we were going to do, she had to drink during the day. One weekend I showed up, and she had decided that she wanted to play she wanted me to play the accordion. And so we went shopping for accordions, and we went to all these music stores, and I have no idea what was at the music stores, but the next weekend I showed up, and she had decided she wanted me to play the harp instead, so we ran around to all the music stores again. But I never got any of these things. I never exactly understood that. I just, that this was a game my grandmother was playing with me so she could get alcohol. And but we'd get back home, and we'd unpack the trunk of liquor, and some cheese and bread. The only thing I ever remember actually eating at my grandmother's house was cheese toast. And we would settle down to watch Lawrence Welk, which was her favorite show. And somewhere in the middle of the bubbles, my grandmother would pass out. Now, you know, I thought she just fell asleep. I didn't understand that once grandmother was asleep, you couldn't wake her up. But I also remember at the age of 4 and a half making a decision that I was really the only one that could take care of me. And, you know, if you think that, if any of you have young children, you think your children don't know you have a problem or you had a problem, then you're wrong. You know, they know something's wrong. I made that decision early on. So many, a Saturday night, grandmother would wake back up, and she would decide that she wanted to go out to the honky-tonks. And these were not the fine ladies' establishments. These were the alcohol, you know, soaked beer of dirt or sawdust or concrete floor places that I would try to curl up in a ball and sleep on while she was partying above me. Yet when Dick asked me if I had any alcoholism in my family, I told him no. I didn't know that was alcoholism. I didn't know that had anything to do with it at all. In Al-Anon's book, From Survival to Recovery, Growing Up in an Alcoholic Home, it says that adult children of alcoholics have an abnormal sense of reality. We think our life was like everybody else, and so we don't know that we're different. I had a little article I found. I'm just going to read a tad from it. This is Al-Anon Faces Alcoholism, which is a magazine that comes out once a year and goes out to professionals to tell them about Al-Anon, and this is a 16-year-old. At 16, I learned to take charge of my life. My father drank away the first 16 years of my life. I grew up seeing my parents fighting all night long and having to leave the house to stay safe. When I was little, I used to let things get under my skin easily. Anything and everything bothered me. I was shy, introverted, and very self-conscious. I thought everyone was whispering about me. In Alateen, I learned that no matter how much I love other people and want the best for them, my personal health has to come first. I need to take charge of my own life, nobody else's. You know, those of you that haven't been to an Al-Anon meeting before, we actually don't talk about alcoholics in there. We talk about ourselves. You know, we may talk about how tough it was to grow up in a certain situation, but we really are there to get well ourselves, because alcoholism has made us sick too. And sometimes I think we're sicker because we didn't have anything to block that pain. You know, I told Dick that I didn't have any alcoholism in my family, and you know, we met when I was in seminary, and I'm not going to tell you my whole story today, but some of you've heard it. But you know, I dated very little in high school, four times in college. I dated a bunch of guys. I went to a Baptist college, and I was a music major. And I found out later on that almost all the guys I ever went out with were gay guys trying not to be gay. And so it's, you know, it was the 70s, and I should have, you know, we didn't know that guys that like Barbara Streisand and love to disco and wear pink, you know, I didn't have any idea what that meant. Anyway, so after college, I decided to go to seminary. There was Joan of Arc, and then there was Barbara the Baptist, and I was going to go save everybody. And so my first semester in seminary, I was playing the piano and leading the children's choirs at this church. And on a Saturday night, a man came in to make amends to the Baptist church. And he got up, he asked if he could talk. He got up and he talked about his alcoholism, and he talked about the fact that he wanted to make amends to the church for things he had said and call them hypocrites. And to do that, he wanted to stay around and be a part of the church for a while. And I had never seen anybody make amends to a Baptist church before or since. And that man is Dick. Now, it wasn't quite that quick, you know. He had been sober about a year and a half or so, and his sponsor told him he could go out if he could find anybody to go out with him. And I was first year in seminary, and he asked me out. And he told me later he'd seen me up in the choir. And he prayed this very eloquent prayer, God, she do. And he asked me to go out with him that day, and I didn't, I don't remember it. I still don't remember it. I don't think I'm going to. We've been married almost 31 years, and I told him no. Because I was going out with somebody else in the church who ended up to be gay. But anyway, so we ran back into each other in Atlanta, and at Lenox Mall, and he was trying to get me to give him my phone number, and we finally realized where we had met at this church, and I gave him my phone number. I think at the time probably to get rid of him, I just wasn't sure what to think, and he called me a bunch of times to ask me out, and I kept telling him no. I don't know why I gave him such a hard time. I really don't. But I finally agreed to go out with him, and the first time we went to a 5-star restaurant, and we went to see a Broadway show, and the second time we went out to an equally nice restaurant and a movie, and the third time we went to Chastain Park, and he had a catered dinner brought in, and the concert was Johnny Mathis. And so, but this was the third date, and so on the third date he told me that he really believed God had planned us to be destined to be together. And I told him I wasn't even sure I was attracted to him. And he told me, because I told him a little bit about me, that he was pretty sure I didn't know what to do with a heterosexual, but which is probably true. But so we didn't date for a while. And so, you know, eventually, I'm going to skip some stuff. Eventually, we did start going out again. I called him and told him I thought I made a mistake, and we He encouraged me to go to Al-Anon. He said he wouldn't marry anybody unless they were in Al-Anon. And so I went to Al-Anon to manipulate him into marrying me. Okay, I didn't have, you know, real high reasons to go. I didn't think I needed it because I didn't have any alcoholism in my family. And, you know, and also I had never dated an alcoholic. Actually, almost everybody I'd ever gone out with was active alcoholic, was a child of an alcoholic, or was a dry drunk. So anyway, we started going out. And I started going to Al-Anon, and I was looking for the perfect meeting in Al-Anon in all of Atlanta. So I rarely went to a meeting more than once. I was jumping all over town. I'd come in during the last minute. I'd leave during the prayer. I was auditing the course. I call it my Cliff Notes version of the program. It would have been the Dummy's Guide to Al-Anon if they'd had one. So anyway, I convinced him I was going to meetings. He suggested I get a sponsor. In fact, he suggested someone, and there was no way I was going to pick who he suggested. So, you know, went to my next meeting. I asked, I listened to the meeting. The woman who did the discussion sounded like she had her act together. I asked her if she'd be my sponsor, and she said, sure. And she said, where are you in the steps? And I said, well, I've already finished my fourth step. And she said, well, why don't you give it to me? I'll read it, to you, and I'll tell you what I think. Now, I had done all four steps an independent study with no sponsor and never going to a meeting more than once or twice. So I really hadn't worked the steps. But anyway, I gave this thing to her, and she called me later that night, and she said, run. And I said, excuse me? She said, run. Don't marry this guy. Your life will be a living hell. You still have time to get out. You don't have to be living with an alcoholic. You'll be sorry the rest of your life. She went on and on. And she said, in fact, my husband is in the other room having sex with another woman right now. I said, I don't think I picked the right sponsor. So, you know, I went back to that meeting one more time to get my fourth step back from her. But alcoholics have blackouts. I have brownouts, you know, eraser outs. I don't know exactly what you call them, but I've talked to other Al-Anons that have this too. She was erased from the memory bank. Okay, one of you could be her. If you are, don't worry. I won't remember because I don't remember her name. I don't remember what she looked like. I remember nothing about her. You know, and that's how resentments, if they were bad, that's where they went. They just went into some escape hatch that seeped out of my brain altogether. It's been a long time. I haven't remembered what she looks like. And I do remember what meeting I met her at, and that meeting doesn't exist anymore, but that's it. So I finally got a sponsor. I don't know that I did anything with her, but I got a sponsor, convinced Dick I was in the program, and we got married. And when we got married, the church was divided into thirds. There was a third that was active alcoholics. They were mostly my family. There was a third that were Baptists, and there was a third that were members of AA. And we had alcohol at the reception for the active alcoholics. I'm not sure who it bothered more, the Baptist or the members of AA, but I'm pretty sure it was the Baptists. And so anyway, movies always end with happily ever after. You know, I didn't know anything that happened after that. And I lived in a family who didn't feel and didn't argue and didn't really talk much about anything. So Dick's family will start a fight over white or wheat bread for dinner. And 3 hours later, they're still arguing. It might be about politics or anything by then, health. And so I didn't really even know how to argue, but suddenly I found myself in arguments. And I kept my bag packed for the first 2 or 3 years we were married. Every now and then, I would ceremoniously announce that I was going to leave, and I would go to the closet, and I would get out my bag, and I'd say, I'm going to go. And he said, okay. And I'd say, no, you don't understand. I'm going to go. And he said, I know you are. I'll see you later. And so I'd go to the door, and I'd put my hand on the door, and I'd look back, and I said, you understand I'm leaving? He said, yes, I do. And so then I'd go out, and then I'd stick my head back in the door and say, I really mean it. I really am going. He said, I know you do. I'll see you later. And so then I'd get to my car, and I would, in my fantasy, I would imagine he would run down the stairs and say, oh, beloved, don't go. And he never, ever did that. By the way, is there any way to make it a little bit cooler in here? I'm just burning up here. I don't know if there is or not. I don't have anything I could take off today. Anyway, so we, sorry, I lost track of where I was. I was leaving. So I got in the car, and, you know, maybe once or twice I went to see my parents, but I didn't really want them to think we were having marriage trouble. And so usually I just drive around, and I come back with my bag, and I'd, you know, come back in the door. I never spend the night out, you know. I'd just be gone for several hours and come back. And I'd say hi, and he said hi, and I'd put the bag back in the closet. Now, I'd like to tell you that I only did that once, but I don't even know how many times I did that. And he thought, I'm not sure which one of us was in more denial. I thought he was well because he had been sober 6.5 years when we got married. And he thought I was well because I didn't have any alcoholism in my life. And I think he was in more denial. I was a mess. And so, and I was still auditing the course. In 1985, we went to the International in Montreal. And we got on a plane, and it was an L-1011, and they don't fly them anymore. I think they're all out in the desert, in the sand somewhere. But there were 5 seats in the middle and 2 on the outside. It was a huge plane. And they made an announcement, were there any friends of Bill W. on the plane? And over 100 people raised their hands. And Dick was so excited. He was bouncing all over the plane, talking to people. I kind of had a picture for just a minute of what he might have been like table hopping when he was drunk. But anyway, he was having so much fun, and I hope all of y'all are planning on going to the International here this summer. You know, Atlanta's going to be blessed to have it here. But we got to Montreal, and you would stop, and like people would run across the street and give you a hug. They were just so excited to see you. And if you've ever seen a new Al-Anon, sometimes we're not even sure we want to hug at all. You know, I've seen them that they're just kind of like do this when you try to hug them. And that was where I was. I just wasn't sure what this program was all about. I was going to meetings, but that was about it. So that night, we got back to the room, and I went into the bathroom, and I came out with a razor, and I said I thought I would just kill myself. Now, I didn't get the reaction that I thought I would. He started laughing at me. Dick started laughing at me, and which a couple of y'all are. And the reality is I wasn't going to hurt myself. It was one of those pink Bic Daisy razors, and I've been using it for about 2 weeks to shave my legs. I mean, I really wasn't going to hurt myself with it. But I was that desperate, you know. I didn't feel like I fit in. I didn't know that I needed a program. And, you know, Dick said, honey, you know, if there's ever a time for you to join Al-Anon for you, it might be here. You're at the International Convention. And in Montreal, Al-Anon's first International was held at the same time as AA's International. And the next morning was the first session of Al-Anon's first International Convention. And the speaker was Lois Wilson. So when I got ready to hear the message of Al-Anon, really for me, the person who brought it to me was Lois Wilson herself. And I still get goosebumps when I talk about that because it was such a gift. And what she talked about that this was a spiritual program. It was a transforming way of living. We never had to be the same again. She didn't say there's a spiritual side of the program. You know, so I hear that sometimes. There's like this spiritual back alley, you know, out there that you'll learn about somewhere. She said it was a spiritual program. It's a way of life that that it has a spiritual element to it, and I heard that. And she also talked about our big three A's, Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, and Alateen, and about how we're a family together. And I thank y'all for letting me participate in this today. And I left Montreal, and I had finally taken the first step. Now, the second and third step were a whole lot harder than I thought they were going to be. See, I went to seminary, but I went to seminary the year that my last year in seminary, my last semester in seminary, was a time when the Baptist Convention passed a resolution, and it basically said Eve was the first to sin, and therefore women should not lead over men, and women in ministry would be strongly discouraged. So I had spent 7 years in post-high school education and was told they didn't want me. Now, I had worked in churches from the time I was 18. I was a summer youth minister. All the time I was in Louisville going to seminary, I was working in churches. I was still working in a church when this resolution was passed, and they didn't fire me, but they weren't paying me much. You know, they didn't have to in Louisville, Kentucky, because they had all the people they could get that needed internships there at the seminary. So anyway, I just was really struggling, because intellectually I knew there was God, but I didn't think that God loved me. And my sponsor had me do a God inventory, and I had to look at everything that had happened to me in churches. I had to look at all the things I had thought about God, and you know, I thought, you know, God is good. I mean, the beginning things that I learned as a kid were okay. It was the stuff that happened in the middle that was bad. And my sponsor also asked me to keep a God journal and to write down anything that was beyond my human understanding that happened in my life. If I got a phone call when I needed it, if I had the money to pay a bill when I needed it, if I got a hug at a meeting if I needed it, if I heard one of your stories and there had to be a power greater than me to help save you, I wrote it down. I love speaker meetings from the very beginning, you know, and I particularly loved AA stories, because there was something about them, this miraculous thing. You know, Jack Sullivan, Dick's first sponsor, you know, was living in a cardboard box, and somebody came up and knocked on the cardboard box and said, "I'm going to make your life miserable if you don't pay this bill." And he said, "Well, I'm living in a cardboard box." And so, you know, but he got sober and he started helping other people, and he got his family back. What a miracle that was. There was some power greater than me out there. I just still wasn't sure that power was going to help me. You know, and Dick and I during this period of time had some real financial problems. And, you know, we've kind of had a financial roller coaster in our life. But this particular roller coaster time was all about me. I think I needed to learn that that God really loved me. And we got to a week we didn't have money for food. And we were both really active in AA and Al-Anon. You know, I was a district representative for Al-Anon. And but I couldn't tell people I was struggling. And so that particular day I was just scared, and I got down on my knees with my dog Booger Bear, who probably went to more conferences than most of you, and I just said, "God, I don't know if you're here. I don't know if you hear me. You know, I don't know. But I'm in trouble, and you know, I need your help. And I hope you can help me." And 2 hours later there was a knock on the front door, and there was a friend of mine standing with 8 bags of groceries. I hadn't seen her in 2-3 months, and she said she just had a feeling I needed them that day, and she brought them to me. Now, so Bill Wilson had his bright light, and Moses had the burning bush, and I don't know what y'all had, but I had 8 bags of groceries, and that's what it took for me to take the second and third step. And then we moved into forgiveness. You know, the process of 4 through 9 in our lives is about reunion. It's about having people back in our lives. Some of them are already gone. I mean, one of them that I needed to do something with was my grandmother. She had already died. And, you know, after I got away from grandmother and found excuses not to go to her house, I just stayed away as much as I could. And I realized I owed her some kind of amends, and I wrote this letter to her about everything that I'd realized that had happened to her was about her alcoholism, and how sad I was to realize that, and the fun things that I remembered about her, and I asked her to forgive me. And I went to her grave, and I took an Al-Anon friend, and I took a camellia bush, which was her favorite plant, and I took some potting soil and some water, and I read the letter there at her grave, and I tore it up in little pieces, and I planted the camellia bush. And I try to go see her grave when the camellias bloom, because it helps me remember, if I'm able to let something go, something beautiful can bloom in its place. with my mom and dad, you know, I had just not included them in a lot of my life. And to begin the process to make amends to my family, you know, I just started calling them. You know, I'd call my mom every day, and I would tell her I loved her, and, you know, ask her what she was doing, and she would tell me what she was fixing for dinner, and it bored me. But, you know, I was being a part of her life. And one of her things she would say, and it got to the point it really irritated me, but I really think I understand it now. I would ask her how she's doing, and she would say, "We're just keeping on, keeping on." And for her, keeping on was like one day at a time. You know, it was her slogan, and it was what she did. And in fact, after she died, I found a notebook, and in it was all this 12-step stuff. I don't know if she ever went to a meeting. I don't know what she studied. I don't know, but she, you know, at least had ventured into looking at the steps. And my mom and dad started getting better through osmosis. They started telling me little bits of their lives. And Dick and I would go to conferences, and we'd call them when we got to the hotel, and we'd give them the room number and a phone number of the hotel, and we'd call them when we got back home. And they never called me at the hotel, but I was being responsible, you know, and there was a period of time where I was just not in their life. And as my parents got older, you know, my mom had a, I'm going to come back to that. You know, Dick really didn't need my help with his sobriety. But, you know, I would go to meetings and I would find things that were interesting. And, you know, if he had his big book out, I would open it to a page I thought maybe would be helpful for him to read. Or I would leave out a piece of literature or whatever it was. And one of the things that bugged me the most was the toilet seat. He mentioned it earlier, and I'm not going to try to create any arguments here. This is just my story. And the third or eighth time I had fallen in the middle of the night because the seat was up, I called my sponsor, and she said, "I want you to try something." And she said, "What?" She said, "No, you have to agree before I tell you what it is. And if your sponsor ever does this to you, you're in trouble." But I said, "Well, okay." And she said, "I want you to put the seat back up for him." And I said, "You want me to do what?" And she said, "I want you to put the seat back up for him. You'll always know it's up. You'll always know you have to put it down. You won't have to worry about it. You won't fall in." And I was pretty mad at the suggestion, but I agreed to try it. And so the first time, I threw the toilet seat back up, and I think I almost broke the back of the toilet. But anyway, it started to get funny because he didn't notice. And, you know, it'd been almost a month, you know, and he hadn't said anything. And I think sometimes I came out of the bathroom giggling, I'm not sure. But he finally said, "Have you developed some kind of new unusual bathroom habit?" And I said, "No, honey, I'm just putting the seat up for you." And, you know, it's never been important again. You know, and actually most of the time it's down. You know, how important is it is one of my favorite slogans. And, you know, I think relationships break up over they start with a seed of something as small as a toilet seat. And then they move into whether you push from the bottom on the toothpaste tube or the middle or whatever. And then they move into, you know, the sink's not clean and who's going to wash the dishes and just all those little petty things. And then the whole relationship starts to disintegrate. How important is it is a great slogan to go by. And I also started to study the traditions, and we started to try to use them in our life. You know, I heard a speaker say once that if someone was not forgiving you, or if you were not forgiving somebody else, it was about one of the following four things: power, protection, punishment, or pride. And the pride is, there's no way I'm going to forgive them first. They got to do it first. I'm not going to lower myself to do that. I wasn't the one that was really wrong, you know. And I've seen people base their whole life over resentment towards a parent. You know, maybe they were physically abused. Maybe, I don't know what happened. Their parents were alcoholic, and by God, I'm going to prove to mom and dad that I can make it anyway. And their whole career is based on that resentment. You know, the power is, I'm not going to forgive you because if I do, then I won't have power over you anymore. And I know a lot of the Al-Anons that I've worked with have trouble seeing this. But they're like dangling a carrot out here. You know, if I don't forgive you yet because I want you to march to my drummer. So those of you that are struggling with somebody who hasn't forgiven you yet, maybe knowing some of these things that Al-Anons do will help. It's not to point them out to them. It's just to accept that that's what they're doing. And that maybe in accepting it, you won't have the same reactions and fights won't happen the same way and things will begin to change. Protection is a really big one. You know, an Al-Anon, particularly with a drinking alcoholic, doesn't want to forgive them because they don't want to be hurt again. And they build up that wall, and they build up that wall, and they build up that wall, and it's so tall because they don't want to be hurt by the alcoholism anymore, and so they're going to hide behind it. And it's difficult to tear it down. I've helped a bunch of people that I've sponsored find ways to do that. And the last one is punishment. You hurt me, and I'm going to hurt you. I'm just going to share a couple forgiveness stories because I've collected them over the years. And one of my favorite ones is, I think all these people have passed away now, is a friend of ours named John Cornelius, who was Santa Claus. And some of y'all may have known him. And John, after he was sober, got divorced, and in the divorce decree, he had to sign that he wouldn't ever see his kids again. And he was just heartbroken about it. I can't remember how many times we talked about it. And his sponsor told him if he was ever supposed to see him again, he would. And he sent him cards, but that was about it. And he became Santa Claus, you know, after he officially retired. And he was Santa Claus in a bunch of different places. And one year he was trying to decide where to be Santa Claus. And one of the places he was offered was Eatontown, New Jersey. And he had once heard a speaker from there that he had liked, and so he decided to go there. That's how he decided. So he's in the mall, and he's being Santa Claus, and a woman comes and sits on his lap, and he says, "What's your name, young lady?" And she looks at him, and she said, "You know my name, Daddy." And it was his daughter, and he hadn't seen her in almost 30 years. And he started crying, she started crying, and the elves that were taking the pictures started crying, and slowly all the people in the stores, you know, heard this story, and it's like people were, you know, hanging over the balconies looking at this reunion of Santa and his daughter. And he called us as soon as he had a break. He called Dick and I and tells the story, and we cried too. And the next year, he went back to that same mall, and his daughter brought his granddaughter. He got to meet his granddaughter. Now, John died a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. Time flies. And he had never had a reunion with his son. He never saw his son again. He just had to accept it, but he saw his daughter again. And his daughter told him about his son. So sometimes those, you know, we do everything we can and nothing happens on the other side. I talk to people about forgiveness all the time, and I look at it from my own perspective because I've had many people in my life that I've had to forgive. And sometimes forgiveness is like walking into heavy traffic and standing in the median. Or even worse, standing on the yellow line in the middle of the traffic. You know, and trying not to get hit. Because you never know if the person's going to come and meet you halfway. And sometimes they don't. Sometimes we just stand there. We do what we need to do and the person never does the other half. But sometimes real reunions happen. You know, I had a roommate in college and I'd gotten mad at her. And I had decided that I wanted to try to make amends to her. I had moved out on her one day, and I didn't leave a forwarding address. I didn't leave the rent that was due the next day. I didn't leave anything. And so when I tried to find her, I couldn't find her. And so I looked in the, and my phone numbers weren't good, and I called The school and the Alumni Association didn't have them, and I thought I was off the hook. But we were in vacation in a city I'd never been to, in a mall, and I saw her walking the other way. And I walked over to her. I said, "I can't believe you're here. I've been trying to find you." I told her a little bit about Al-Anon, and then I knew I owed her amends. I looked in my wallet. I had about the amount of money I thought that I probably owed her. I pulled it out. I pulled out a business card, and I handed it to her, and I said, I want to give this to you." And she never said a word. She just stared at me like this. But it was her. And and she called me about a year later, and she said, "Barbara, you'll never know what gift you gave me that day." You know, I had for so many years, I had canceled her relationship with her mother and with all these other people in her life, and because I'd made amends to her, it had paid for it. She had renewed relationships with other people in her life because it had inspired her to do that. So sometimes we don't know why we do it, and we have no idea what happens on the other end, but sometimes it pays for it. And that one could have paid for it and me never hear about it, but she decided to call and let me know. I want to go back to the, because I forgot to tell you the story, and it's important for you to know. Go back to my struggles with the church and my prayer and the 8 bags of groceries. During that time, during the inventory that I wrote, I wrote about a lot of crazy interviews that I had, and I'm only going to tell you about one of them. I had an interview. I was still living in Louisville and trying to find a job in a church, and I had an interview in Alabama, and the interview was in a town, and I do not remember the name of it. I have no idea. You could have been in this interview and I wouldn't have known, but actually if you were, you probably would have been three, so you know. Anyway, I walked into this church, and there was a big circle of chairs, and there was one in the middle. And I walked in and I sat down in the chair, and the man across from me said, "We just want to see what someone like you, a woman, who would have the audacity to apply for this job would look like. That's all." And I didn't know what to say. Now, I've thought of a lot of things since then, but the words that came out of my mouth were, "I hope you're going to pay my expenses," because I'd driven from Louisville, Kentucky to Lower Alabama. I don't know where. That's that eraser out thing. The name of the church, the people, what the people look like are all gone. what happened is a man from this part of the circle threw some money on the floor when I asked if they were going to pay my expenses. And I picked it up and I walked out of the circle, and that became God to me, and I had no idea it happened. You know, that had nothing to do with God. It had absolutely nothing to do with God. God had to give me 8 bags of groceries for me to get over that, you know. But for some reason or other, you know, I had internalized that God didn't want me. You know, and there I've talked to so many people in both fellowships that are wounded, that something happened to them in a church, and the spiritual wounds are deep. And sometimes those steps really do hold hands with each other. And if you're still struggling with this program being a spiritual program, think about doing a God inventory. I know it made all the difference for me. Since that time, I've had several things that I've done to try to make further amends. A couple years ago, Dick and I went back to the seminary I went to, and we went into the chapel. And he said, I told him I felt like I needed to go there. And I thanked God for my education, because what happened out of my education is I had my major was music and counseling. And when I was doing Al-Anon service, representing Al-Anon at a professional conference here in Georgia, a friend of mine came up to me and said, "You went to seminary, didn't you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Would you like to be chaplain at a women's halfway house?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to." And from that, I got my master's level certification in addiction, and I've been working in addiction for 26 years. And I've done all kinds of things. And right now, I really need your prayers, because I'm in between, and I'm asking for God's direction and where I'm supposed to go from here. My last job was as National Clinical Outreach Director traveling around the country and representing a particular treatment center. But I'm not really sure what I'm supposed to do now. And, you know, from that, I had a friend of mine who had hosted me at the West Virginia Al-Anon Convention call me and ask me to go do communion with his brother. And I said, Booth, I'm not ordained. He said, I don't care. Go get some grape juice and some bread and go visit my brother. And by the way, somebody will ordain you. I dare you. And so I got my ordination about 5 or 6 years ago, and I had no idea why. And the first thing I did after I got my ordination, and I would never, ever, ever have expected this, was I was asked to do a funeral service for a girl I sponsor. Her name was Karen Miracle. Some of y'all may have known her. And I had never done a funeral service. I wasn't even sure I knew how to do a funeral service. They picked me because I was in the program and I was her sponsor and they knew I was a minister. And so the day before the service, I was sitting at home and I was praying that I would have some kind of sign of what I was supposed to do. And I went to look out the door. We have a glass door where we live. And I saw a hawk land on the banister. And the hawk stared at me, and I stared at the hawk. I had no idea why the hawk was there. And but I am an 8th Cherokee, and when I finally looked away and the hawk flew off, I went and looked up Native American meanings hawk. And a hawk is a messenger of God encouraging us to rise over the earthly plane and see our lives from a new perspective. And so I did the service about seeing life and death from a new perspective and her life from a new perspective. And from there on, I saw hawks every day for 222 days. And I was traveling a lot back then. And so I saw hawks in Seattle. I saw seahawks at the beach in Florida. One day up in Pennsylvania, I saw 56 on one day and told God he was showing off. And so, you know, I just saw them everywhere. So I knew I was supposed to begin to look at my life from a new perspective. I lived the majority of my life in yesterday, looking at resentment and things that I hadn't let go of, or in tomorrow land. How can I make this happen? How could I manipulate a situation? Get something to happen that would benefit me, that I had missed my own life. And I never really liked the slogan one day at a time, because I had no clue how to do it. I didn't live in today. I think the eraser out had as much to do with the fact that I didn't live in my own life. You know, Dick and I were down in Savannah at a conference, and we ate at a restaurant. He said, do you remember when we ate here, you know, our second year marriage? And I didn't remember at all. You know, I had no memory of being there before. And, you know, I can say that I've started to try to live my life in today and look for those miracles in my life today, and I see them. When my parents started to get, they were housebound. You know, there was no exits from their house that didn't involve stairs, and they were having physical problems. And during that time, period of time, my mother was in this organization that I never really understood. It was kind of like the Yaya Sisterhood. But she asked me to give her her 50-year pin, which I did. And then when my mom and dad celebrated their 50th anniversary, Dick and I gave them a big 50th anniversary party. And we finally encouraged them to move out of this house that they kept on hurting themselves in, and moved them into the senior apartment that was nearer to us. And we got them all new furniture and put pictures of everybody they loved all over the walls. And they had white dining tablecloths and, you know, places to eat. And, you know, we just thought it was the greatest thing. And that was in August. And in January of the next year, I got a call that my dad had been found non-responsive, and they had not been able to, they'd not been able to revive him. And that he was dead at WellStar and COP. And so because of the God of my understanding and Delta Airlines, Dick was still there. He was supposed to be speaking in Colorado, and he had gotten out on the tarmac. and was out there 3 hours while they said they were going to fix the plane. And they finally brought the plane back in, said they were going to have to get a new one. And he was the Friday night speaker in Colorado. And so he'd already called, and they had gotten somebody else to speak. And so he was home with me during all this. And we had a beautiful service for my dad. My mom hadn't really gotten dressed up in a while. And so I fixed her hair and put her makeup on, and all her friends and her family and everybody came to see her and for my dad's service. And Dick and I went off to Hilton Head to the roundup there the next day, and we decided to stay over a day. And on Monday we were sitting out on the dock having some shrimp and trying to recover from my dad's death, and got a call that my mom had been found non-responsive and that they'd revived her, but they weren't sure she was going to make it, and I better hurry if I wanted to see her. And so we started, you know, driving back, and Dick was mad and I was in shock. And Dick got pulled over by the police for going too fast, and I think God wanted him to have somebody to be angry at other than him. And I remember stopping at a Wendy's on the way back, and we walked into the Wendy's, and on the music in the Wendy's, it was playing How Great Thou Art. And I never heard of him in a Wendy's, you know, before or since. And I was actually in the bathroom, and I asked the woman in the other stall, and, "Is that How Great Thou Art?" And she said, "It sure is. I've never heard of him in a Wendy's." And so we had just sung that hymn at my dad's service. And so it was like, okay, God, you're with me in this. So we got back to the hospital, and I was holding one of my mom's hands, and Dick was holding the other, and we were saying the Lord's Prayer. And right in the middle of "Thy will be done," she passed. And I had heard a lot of people talk about in stories in AA and Al-Anon about the gift of being with a parent when they passed. And I never knew that I wanted to have that gift. But the woman who brought me into the world, I was with when she left. But it was 10 days after my dad died. You know, and I was in shock. And she died on Groundhog's Day. And I had seen that stupid Bill Murray movie just one too many times. And I did not want to do the same funeral again. You know, and it was just 10 days later. And so I told Dick, because I was too much in shock to even do it. And I said, "I don't care what we do, but we can't do the same thing we just did." And so he called, and he found a member of AA who was a pastor who said, "Come do it at my church." And we also hadn't gotten any insurance money. And we had a cover dish reception that AA's and Al-Anon's put together for us. And somebody was a florist and said, "I'll bring the flowers," and somebody was a musician and said, "I'll sing," somebody else said, I'll play the piano. And so we had a recovery service for my mom. And you know, but it was hard. It was really during that time that I had to really learn how to live in today, because just a few months before that, Booger Bear, who was that dog that had meant so much to me and I'd prayed with when the bags of groceries were delivered, but died. And Booger Bear was 18 when he died, and Dick and I were never able to have children. He had actually, like, become our child. And we sobbed the day we had to bury him. And we kiddingly told each other we weren't sure we would cry that much for each other when we died. But he had unconditional love. And if you've ever looked at the word dog in the mirror, you know, reverse the letters and it's God. And there's something about unconditional love that I learned from my dog. You know, I truly learned about God's unconditional love. And I'm not saying Booger Bear was my higher power. Somebody asked me that before. But I'm saying that those lessons I learned from him helped me understand that the God of my understanding had unconditional love. Around that time, Dick found out he had esophageal cancer, and he didn't tell me. And a lot of y'all have heard him tell that story, and I'm not going to tell the whole story, but he didn't tell me because I just lost Booger Bear, my mom and dad, and he was looking up the stats of esophageal cancer, and they were not good, and he was trying to find an answer before he talked to me, and it took him a lot of work, but he finally found one place that would do it in Rochester, New York. Now, if you're a girl who was born in Atlanta, you do not want to go to Yankee Land to see your dad die. I mean, see your husband die, you know. So I just wasn't sure. And I didn't have much time to prepare. So we got on the phone and we called. I had been an Al-Anon delegate for Georgia, and he'd been an AA delegate for Georgia. We called the contact people we knew that had been delegates, and we were supposed to speak in Syracuse the next year. We called them, and the day we arrived in Rochester at the hotel where I was going to be staying through all this, there were 23 people from our new AA and Al-Anon home groups, and there to greet us. And we went to Strong Memorial, and the day we went there, Dick talks a lot about the thing that got him through that time was the 23rd Psalm. And he just started repeating it over and over again to himself. And he told me about that. And when we got to the chapel there at the hospital, on the wall in gold was, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." We knew we were at the right place. And we went out in the lobby and we looked up who Strong was. And that hospital was endowed by Dr. Leonard Strong, who was part of founding the AA Foundation, which had saved his life the first time. He was Bill Wilson's brother-in-law, and he founded this hospital where we were. So, you know, you see the power of this worldwide fellowship when you go through something like that. You know, during that time, my phone and Dick's phone, because I had his cell phone too, would fill up two or three times a day with people just saying they love me. Clancy started calling me every day during that period of time. If you know who Clancy was, the first time I got a phone call from Clancy, I was a little scared. But, you know, Clancy's a really good friend now, you know. He actually told me I was his favorite Al-Anon speaker, but I think he comes up and tells that to all the Al-Anons now because he wants to make people think he likes Al-Anons. Anyway, I'm just kidding. I really like Clancy. And you know, God was with me. The day of Dick's surgery, it was a 15-hour surgery. It's the only day of the week that they have a daytime Al-Anon meeting, and the daytime Al-Anon meeting happens to be right across from the hospital. So I actually went to an Al-Anon meeting in the middle of his surgery. And a month ago, I spoke in Rochester, New York, and a woman who'd been in that meeting that day asked me to come speak there. And I got to see those people who were there for me. And the couple who took care of me and made me go out and eat and did my laundry. Again, I hadn't seen them in a long time. You know, as we're able to let things go, something beautiful can bloom in its place. I know that's been true for me. You know, Dick and I have not had an easy life. Things have been tough along the line, but They have been so much better than we ever imagined. A couple other forgiveness stories. Dick mentioned Sandy Beach. Our dear friend Sandy's daughter was murdered on her front lawn. And it was the day she was supposed to go negotiate something about divorce payments. And they've never proven anything, but the timing seemed unfortunate. And his other daughter shortly after that died from this disease. He lost both of his daughters in about a 2-month period of time. And he was speaking down in Cocoa Beach at a conference where Dick and I were also attending, and Dick was speaking. And Sandy said the first thing he said to anybody was, "Well, I forgive the person who shot her." And nobody could believe that. And he said, "If I can't forgive her, then God can't forgive me. If I can't forgive that person, then God can't forgive me." And that example was incredible. And we had another friend, Ed Mutum. And Ed Mutum got sober, and he was really struggling. He'd been a thug in his hometown and before he got sober. And he was getting better, and he had just had dinner. He just had a meal with his dad, and his dad told him he loved him for the first time he remembered. And he went to an AA meeting, and when he came out of the AA meeting, there were a bunch of people to greet him, and they told him that his father had gone into a bar, and a bunch of people had come in and shot and killed him. And, you know, Ed's reaction from old was to go out and find the guys and kill them. But that's why he had so many people greeting him. But instead, you know, he hung in there, and through that inspiration, it took a while, but Ed ended up becoming a minister. And on a Sunday morning, he was preaching about forgiveness, and he stopped in the middle of his talk. He said, "You know, I can't talk about forgiveness again unless I'm willing to do my own work." He said, I haven't forgiven the people who killed my dad, and I need to do that. So he found out who they were. One of them was in prison. One of them was trying to get sober. And so he went to the parole hearing of the guy that was in prison who was trying to get sober, and he testified on behalf of him and said, you know, I'd like this guy to have another chance, and I'd like for y'all to let him out. And the parole board said, we'll let him out, but only to you. So Ed took in to his home the guy who had been a part of shooting his dad. Now, you talk about a forgiveness story. And because of that story, Ed was asked to speak all over the world. And actually, Ed died 5 years ago, something like that. And he was, the year that he died, he was scheduled to be at a symposium with the Dalai Lama and with Desmond Tutu and a bunch of other people, a symposium on forgiveness. His story of forgiveness certainly has inspired me to do all my own work. You know, wherever you are today in that process, I encourage you not to stop, but to do the work you need to do. With people that I sponsor, when they're really struggling with forgiving someone, and I've had to do this myself, I encourage them to do this ritual. It may help you, it may not. But I encourage them to write down on a little piece of paper the name of the person or some symbol of what they're resenting, if it's the church or whatever. Write it down on a piece of paper and somehow, or write it down somehow, and get rid of it every day until the knot starts to loosen. And I've had some real creative sponsees. I had one who would write it on an egg every day and go throw it at a tree. I had several that have written it on toilet paper and used it. But you know, it's as the things change, I've had them write it and bury it at the grave of the person that they still resent who's dead. Or to attach it to a helium balloon and let it go, which I've done, or write the name in the sand at the beach and let the waves wash it away. And as the things move from an angry way to let it go to a positive way to let it go, something miraculous happens. Karen, my sponsee who died, who I did her service, 2 days before she died, called me to say, you know, I've finally forgiven my mother. I'm glad she did. She certainly didn't know she was going to die 2 days later. When my mom and dad died, I remember the gratitude I had that I had done my own work, that this program had allowed me to do my own work, that I didn't have to stay caught in that. If it's somebody that resents you, you know, I can't tell you how to start. There's no miraculous ways to do that. You know, I've known moms and dads who've sent cards to kids for years and written little notes and told them what they're doing, maybe send them a picture, whatever. And sometimes there's a reunion that happens, and sometimes there's not. There's no promises here. But I can tell you that you'll be better if you do your own work. And that's what the miraculous part of this program, AA and Al-Anon and our groups together, if we're willing to come and be a part of each other's lives and share in these fellowships and do the hard work of the steps, and the result is reunion. And I thank y'all for letting me be with you today.